Protests, blackouts, and petitions put pressure on Congress last month to delay voting on two anti-piracy bills known as SOPA and PIPA. Critics argue that passage would have been a threat to freedom of expression on the internet. Supporters countered that internet piracy is a serious problem and it needs to be stopped. Well, we want to take advantage of the lull in the debate to understand what it was all about and to see if there's a compromise that would preserve the openness of the internet while shutting down rogue sites that steal content. We asked Larry Downs to join us. He's a consultant and author who writes about the intersection of technology, business, and politics. He's written several books, including Unleashing the Killer App, Digital Strategies for Marketing Dominance, and he's currently a senior fellow for Tech Freedom, and that's a technology think tank. And Larry Downs, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
So where are SOPA and PIPA today?
Well, they're sleeping. there's other things going on in Washington, of course, and with the election coming up, I think it's unlikely that either of those bills will reappear before, you know, after the presidential election, but you never know.
Do you think Congress was chastened by the level of criticism about these bills?
Well, I think Congress was deeply shocked, and I don't think they've actually yet figured out what really happened. The sort of response that came, particularly in the couple of weeks there after the beginning of the year, that led to the reversal on quick passage of both those bills that was planned. I don't think it was really precedented in terms of who was doing it and how it was done, and I think members of Congress are still trying to figure out, you know, what hit them. They know something hit them, but I don't think they know what it was.
I was thinking about the late Senator Stevens of Alaska, famously a couple years ago, when asked to describe the internet, said it was a bunch of tubes. Do you think Congress really understands the problem that they were trying to solve?
No, I don't. And, of course, you know, one thing that's worth remembering about Senator Stevens was he was in charge of the subcommittee that oversaw regulation of the Internet, so his lack of understanding was even more poignant than others. No, I mean, the one thing that was really shocking, especially to me and to users of the Internet, was just during the one and only hearing that actually happened on SOPA, was just hearing, you know, one congressman after another start their comments by saying, well, you know, I don't really understand this technology, or I don't really use this technology, or my kids tell me this is how Facebook works. And, you know, just sort of casually admitting and thinking it was okay to admit. In fact, they thought it was kind of cute to admit that they didn't know what they were talking about, but that they were going to go ahead and pass, you know, some fairly severe regulations against probably, you know, the one technology that's driving economic growth in the last few years on its own.
I'm not a member of Congress, but I have to admit that my level of ignorance on this as well, but that's part of the reason that we're doing this program. Let me ask you, though, a couple of questions. Is internet piracy a problem?
Well, I think just as a starting point, I really hesitate to use words like piracy. You know, piracy is a violent crime that occurs in the physical world on the high seas. I know it's the term that's preferred by some of the proponents of these bills, but what they're talking about is not piracy in any you know, legitimate sense of the word. They're talking about unlicensed use of copyrighted material. That is a crime, depending on how it's done, or at least it's a civil wrong that can be addressed through the courts. Whether or not it's a serious problem is hard to tell, because most of the data that we have, again, from the proponents of additional legislation, is extremely poor and unscientific, and a lot of it relies sort of on guesstimates that have been hanging around for 10 years and been kind of like a game of whispers, just keeps getting repeated over and over again, and every time it does, they add a zero or two to the number. So we know, of course, that unlicensed use happens, and in particular, we know that there are some off-site foreign websites that have actually set themselves up to, you know, sell movie streaming and song streaming and pretend to actually be legitimate licensed sites. Those, of course, are genuine criminal enterprises and ought to be shut down. But whether or not they rise to the level of requiring such dramatic and drastic legislation as has been proposed, particularly with SOPA and PIPA, I think that's a much more unclear question. And I really, you know, regret the fact that the debate has happened in the last 6 months without any real data to examine. Because after all, lawmakers should really only regulate or legislate when there's a clear problem that's identifiable and when the solution can be narrowly tailored to address that problem. Without the kind of data that we need, we really can't say whether those pieces of legislation were good ideas or bad ideas.
Well, and looking at the SOPA and PIPA legislation, of course, knowing that there was a lot of criticism, was the intended goal to try to go after these foreign websites?
Yes, particularly with the PIPA, which was the Senate version that was introduced earlier. That was fairly narrowly targeted at websites operating outside of the normal jurisdiction of the United States. The initial draft of SOPA, which came out in November of last year from the House, that was more of a grab bag. There was a lot in it that had to do with foreign sites and foreign activities, but there was also a sort of a lot of miscellaneous provisions that had nothing to do with foreign sites that actually dealt with domestic activities, much of which, by the way, is already covered by a wide range of legislation that's been passed over the last 10, 20 years.
But is it possible, in the world of the Internet, to identify who is a foreigner and who's domestic?
Well, the bills did that very specifically by talking about registration of a domain name. So when you have a website, like WHYY has a website,
yes.
you register that, and that puts it in all the tables that allow people to get to you without actually knowing the specific address of the computer. The registration has to happen with a limited number of companies, and for .com registration. All that has to happen inside the United States. So if you are a .com or even a .org, you are registered in the United States, and therefore the United States government or civil parties can get jurisdiction over you if you've violated the law in some ways. So these bills were targeted at domain names that were registered outside the United States and therefore couldn't be gotten at through the registration process.
But that was part of the criticism by going after domain names, yes?
Right. Well, the problem was because the registrations were outside the United States, you couldn't simply go to the registrar and say, this domain name has been seized or, this domain name is to be blocked. And so what PIPA and SOPA did was to introduce a whole list of new remedies that wouldn't actually take down the website, but sort of try to make it look as if the website was gone. And a lot of those remedies would have done a lot of tinkering with the underlying engineering of the Internet in ways that would have had tremendously damaging, unintended secondary consequences.
It's interesting, and this rolls back the clock a bit, but looking at the debate over SOPA and PIPA, is it seemed to pit, and this is speaking broadly, Hollywood versus Silicon Valley. And frankly, I stole that from some of the reading that I did. Is that a helpful way to think about what this debate was about?
It's not really. I think because in part, as we saw, there was a kind of a general uprising, a revolt of Internet users. And although the content industries would like us to think that revolt was staged and operated by the large Internet companies, particularly Google and Wikipedia and Craigslist and so on, the truth is that it was essentially a true grassroots uprising. It didn't, it was users across the world, particularly in the United States, who self-organized using the kind of social networking and social news site tools that they use every day for, more mundane activities. They used those tools to really kind of stage a protest and did so without any kind of corporate oversight from any particular industry. But it is true that the content industries are under a lot of pressure, and I don't want to suggest, as I say, that the data I don't really put much faith into, but it's certainly true that the digital distribution has made it much easier to use licensed content without the proper licenses. And so the content industries have, and this is, by the way, you can go much further back than just SOPA and PIPA. Over the last 20 years, there have been, 10, 15 attempts, successful attempts, to add regulations or legislation to kind of change copyright in particular, to, kind of beef up the penalties, to extend the term, to give new rights, to make new criminal sanctions, in a way to respond to the ease with which digital distribution makes it possible to avoid the licensing scheme. And this is one of the efforts that just didn't succeed for them.
Let me ask you, though, a basic question, and this is based on some notion that some version of PIPA or SOPA had gotten passed. For the individual user, and let's say I wanted to get some illegal version of a movie that I wanted, what would have happened to me if one of these bills had been passed?
Well, the bottom line is nothing would have happened to you. These bills, I think the general consensus was that the remedies that were being introduced would have been largely ineffective at stopping or even probably slowing the kind of the wholesale criminal unlicensed use of copyrighted material. So, as I say, these websites would not have been taken down because right. They're outside the U.S. and we couldn't have gotten to them. What would have happened is it would have been slightly harder for you to find them. And probably after, a few months of innovative entrepreneurial work by the criminals, it probably wouldn't have been any harder for you to find them. So if you were genuinely trying to get to a rogue website outside the United States, you would have had a momentary, sort of difficulty in doing what you wanted to do, but probably it wouldn't have lasted very long at all.
Would anyone have, in a sense, paid the price for that transaction?
Well, probably, as I say, kind of unintended consequences. There would have been.
Whoops. Do we still have you, Larry Downs? Let's try to call him back. We are talking about or putting SOPA and PIPA into some kind of context today on Radio Times. And Larry Downs has been our guest. He's a consultant, author, writes about this intersection between technology, politics, and business. And frankly, he's our first guest to setting us up to a debate that we're going to host in the second portion of Radio Times. Larry, you still back? Are you back with us?
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm here.
Okay, that's okay. I'm not sure what happened. We have about a minute before our first break here. I guess my basic question was, if one of these bills had been passed, who would someone have been arrested?
the criminal sanctions wouldn't have reached, as I say, we couldn't go outside the U.S., although, of course, the United States has treaty partners and other obligations that, and we saw this, by the way, just last month with the crackdown on the mega upload site, where they could coordinate with their trading partners or with local law enforcement to do arrests when there are criminal activities afoot. So that, of course, can already happen, and it could have continued to happen under SOPA and PIPA. I think more likely that the real victims would have been kind of average internet users who might have tried to there would have been sort of confusion about when they were getting to a site, if they were actually getting to the site they wanted, or if they were looking on a search engine, if they were looking for particular links, and they couldn't really trust whether those links were accurate anymore because the search engine had been ordered to kind of, tinker with them in ways, as I say, that would have not really hurt the criminals, but probably would have made it more difficult for legitimate users to do what they want.
Well, hold on. We're going to come back to you in about 20 minutes. That's Larry Downs. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
WHYY programming is supported by the teachers and education support professionals of the Pennsylvania State Education Association, educating all children for a bright future. We are PSEA, providing the power of a great education.
Nothing livens up a summer day like a hummingbird sighting. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, I'll reveal what you can do to lure these little winged wonders to your landscape. Plus organic answers to an especially large selection of your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
The Soweto Gospel Choir has won acclaim around the world for their musical artistry and high-energy performances. Now on a 43-city North American tour, they stopped by our Washington, D.C. studios, and we will share the magic. That is next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Hello. this is Margaret Kuo. To celebrate the Cherry Blossom Festival with the Japan American Society, Dr. Hamada from Villanova and I will present a tutorial launching in my Wynn restaurant on Sunday, February 26th. Margaret Kuo's restaurants support WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Two internet anti-piracy bills proposed by Congress known as SOPA and PIPA have been put on hold after intense and vocal opposition. We're talking about what the fuss was about and where does this issue go from here. And we have two guests who are going to join us and debate this issue in the second portion of Radio Times. David Cohen is AFL-CIO Executive Director of the Department of Professional Employees. And David Cohen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, you're very welcome. Also with us is Corinne McSherry, lawyer and intellectual property director at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And Corinne McSherry, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
It's my pleasure.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. David Cohen, what's the AFL-CIO doing as part of this debate?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. This is a major issue of jobs, incomes, and benefits for hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of workers. And I have the pleasure and honor of working for a coalition of 22 national unions. They collectively represent about 4 million professional and technical people. 9 of those unions are in the arts, entertainment, and media industries. And foreign rogue websites have had a huge impact on jobs, incomes, and benefits for those workers. Unions are organized by workers. They're democratic. We didn't make up this issue. They brought it to us. And they include all sorts of people that you never see on your television or movie screen. Musicians and editors and cinematographers and hairdressers and electricians.
David, only just because we have to squeeze this debate into 20 minutes here, I'll come back to you, but let me give Corinne McSherry a chance to weigh in on this, and I know your organization and others oppose SOPA and PIPA. How come?
Well, for us, the collateral damage that these bills were going to cause tremendously far outweighed any possible benefits to the folks that David represents. It was going to cause tremendous problems for internet security, and you don't have to take my word for it. 100 top internet engineers said so. The language was incredibly vague and would encompass and affect all kinds of new companies coming up in the United States and abroad. It sent a terrible signal to the world that censoring the internet is okay as long as you call it IP enforcement as opposed to political enforcement. There was a tremendous lack of transparency and participation and an opportunity for the people affected to even participate in formulating these bills. And it really came to a head when there was a hearing on the bills where the bill's own proponents were very clear that they didn't understand themselves what they were getting into and what the possible effects of these bills were going to be, and they wanted to rush them through anyway. And I think
that
really scared
me. If you're referring to the House bill?
Referring to the House bill, the markup in particular.
I think that point is important, Marty.
Go ahead.
One of the things that I just heard Corinne say is that there was no chance to weigh in. The predecessor legislation in the Senate, which Larry Downs described as narrowly tailored, began at the start of 2010. There were multiple hearings. There was a lot of outreach. And the tech community did not join in any of the discussion. In fact, even at the House hearing, other witnesses followed House procedure and provided testimony in advance. My boss, the elected president of the coalition for which I worked, provided his testimony in advance. A junior-level Google person showed up with no advance testimony and was repeatedly asked by House members where the tech community had been in providing input.
Well, let me get...
I just want to underscore, this is an issue about workers in a tough, tough economy. And it got blown out of the water by misrepresentations as to the content of the legislation.
Well, let me give Corinne McSherry a chance to respond to that. Corinne, go ahead.
Well, this is one thing we've been hearing a lot lately since the protests on January 18th, that somehow the public was just misinformed and didn't understand and was confused and misled by their leaders or something like that, which I think is really does a tremendous disservice to the public. I mean, with the public, I mean, I hardly anyone could read this 70-page bill. I mean, I've read it. I expect David
There's
has, but lots of other people have.
There's a congressional
okay, hold on.
Research summary.
Okay.
If you don't mind,
yeah,
I'll
go ahead, Corinne. Yeah,
you.
I'll give you a chance,
the
David.
The point
go
is
ahead.
That what I think the public heard is they heard from 100 law professors who said this bill is unconstitutional. They heard from Internet engineers, including Vint Cerf, people who founded the Internet, who told them these bills are going to cost serious problems to Internet infrastructure. They heard from human rights leaders who had looked at the bill and said, this is going to cause tremendous problems for our community. And they said, huh, all of these people are telling us this is a really serious problem. Let's stop this runaway train that these bills seem to be on.
Go ahead, David Cohen.
Marty, thank you. Corinne, yes, the House bill was 78 pages. However, there's a two-page congressional research summary of the legislation. I received multiple phone calls from journalists, and I asked them two questions. One, have you read the congressional research summary of the legislation or the legislation? Unanimously, the answer was no. And two, have you ever hired someone and then not paid them? And what would you call that if you did? And that seems to me what this is about. This is about our members include writers and performers, creators, craftspeople. They make their living by the First Amendment. They are ferocious defenders and advocates for the First Amendment. They had endorsed the Senate legislation. But the result of the online descriptions was to lump both pieces of legislation together, and it was the Senate bill that was coming for a preliminary vote. So the short version, Marty, from our perspective, is that we are in a situation where there are lots of experts who said the Senate bill did nothing to the First Amendment. It did not violate it in any way. Our members, as I said, are avid defenders of that. And there's another aspect to the forum.
Well, you know what? Hold on one second, because I want to give Corinne McSherry an equal time here. Corinne, just picking up on what David Cohen said and the way he describes the problem, do you think there is a problem of rogue websites? And I clearly you're a critic of SOPA and PIPA, but do you think there's a problem out there and that there is another way to address it?
Well, look, I think that there is no question that there is a tremendous amount of online infringement. I mean, there's no point in disputing that.
Right.
And there's no point in disputing that some of it happens on offshore sites. The question, it seems to me, though, is what's the right way to address it? What's the answer? What's the thing that's going to actually help the people that David represents? And what we have learned over the past decade is that the answer is not to be found in Washington, D.C. The answer is innovation. That is the only thing that has ever worked. And I would point you to, for example, the music industry. The record labels spent years suing every peer-to-peer file sharing service out of existence, hitting them here, hitting them there, suing individuals. But you know what actually worked in terms of actually encouraging people to move away from peer-to-peer systems and actually start paying for music? Was giving them something they actually wanted. Give them something that's good. So we have services now, finally, like Spotify, which took years to negotiate the license when it was skyrocketing and doing incredibly well in Europe. But in the United States, the record labels just would not come to the table and make the deal, until just very recently, about 6 months ago. And they left so much money on the table when they were doing that. So it seems to me that the right answer is a business solution. It's not going to be found in D.C., and spending money on lobbyists is the worst way is the worst way to answer this problem. You should spend your money on new business and your business departments, not your lawyers.
Does that make sense to you, David Cohen?
I wish it did. You know, you have your kid in a store and things are expensive, and you explain to your kid you can't really afford to buy it, so you should steal it. And that's supposed to lead the store to a new business model. The solution that Corinne describes is fine in theory, but until we get there, it doesn't help. And it certainly doesn't help with regard to criminal foreign websites in China, Ukraine, and Russia, which are making hundreds of millions of dollars from selling access to streaming or downloading or running ads on those. The only way to get at those foreign websites profiting at the expense of American workers is to go after the things that give them access to American consumers. Well, then workers can benefit.
Well, let me just do a quick follow-up here, and then I'll get you back in, Corinne, as well. But David, but why not then follow the money? If there are foreign companies that are making, you know, gobs of money off this illegal content, why not go after the money?
Well, actually, that's a great question, Marty. That's exactly what the Senate legislation tried to do. After court review, pay agents, credit card companies and others, internet service providers, search engines, could be told, that's a foreign rogue website primarily dedicated to stealing digital content. You shouldn't be helping them reach U.S. consumers. After court review, on application of the Department of Justice, complete due process narrowly tailored to foreign rogue websites. Mm. Current legislation in the U.S. does not and cannot reach them because they're outside the bounds of the U.S.
Corinne McSherry, your thoughts or your response?
Well, so first of all, I would echo something that I think Larry mentioned when he was on the show. I heard the tail end, which is that even the follow the money approach is unlikely to actually work because there will be workarounds within weeks, if not sooner. That's sort of one problem. Is again, you have to do the cost benefit analysis here. You know, what's going to work to actually help people and help address the issue. So that's one concern that I have. But I think that also the concern that many people had is that both bills went well beyond the so-called follow the money approach to include domain name blocking provisions, which were maybe going to be taken out, maybe not. We weren't really sure what the new language would be. And that was going to balkanize the Internet in a really unfortunate way.
But do you, and just picking up on something you said earlier, Corinne, mm-hmm. are you talking about music industry or perhaps even using the music industry as a model, but the movie industry making content available, more content available, affordable, attractive, so that consumers will actually pay for this stuff?
Exactly. You can compete with free. The way you compete with free is that you offer a better service, and people are actually doing this and doing incredibly well. There's all kinds of examples where people are taking advantage of new technologies as opposed to fighting them and are really profiting. We had, you know, a comedian, Louis C.K., made a couple $1 million in a couple weeks by offering his show available for download and said, please pay me $5. But he couldn't, but admitting, if you want to copy it, I can't really stop you. And he made a couple $1 million in 2 weeks. You know, and that's just one of many, many examples where you don't have to just reinforce the old business model in order for people to do well.
What do you think? I asked you this earlier, David Cohen, but moving forward, I mean, if this illegal content is out there and these bills at least are on hold or, you know, in mothballs temporarily, what about thinking in this business model term, a new business model term? Would that help your constituents?
Look, we're very much in favor of people coming to the table with proposals. The Office of the Intellectual Property Enforcement Coordinator at the White House negotiated some wonderful voluntary standards with, for example, the pay agents, MasterCard, PayPal, and others. There's a huge amount that business can do, but it's not doing it, and it won't do it unless there is a common floor, because these secondary elements of the Internet ecosystem, search engines, ad networks, and so on, profit by doing nothing with regard to illegal content. Hmm. Every time someone looks for an illegal website on Google, that's one more pair of eyeballs that Google sells to advertisers. And what's fascinating to me is to hear Corinne say, follow the money, don't follow the money, because pressed at the same House hearing, the spokesperson for Google said, we want you to follow the money.
Hmm. Well, so okay, let me get on that.
Yeah, hold on.
First of all,
hold on. Wait. Hold on. Just one. Finish your sentence there, David, and then Corinne, I'll get you in.
The common theme here is anything but effective action on behalf of American workers.
Go ahead, Corinne.
Okay, well, I obviously disagree with that being the common theme. And the other thing I would point out is the fact that I might say something different from what Google would say shouldn't be at all surprising, because I don't speak for Google. I speak for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and we speak for the users, which is a different voice. And I think there's been an effort to sort of suggest that this is all about Google, and I think that that's wrong. The other thing that I am trying to say about the follow the money approach is I want to focus on what I think might actually work. And I think that there's been a tremendous mistake on the part of the folks who are concerned about infringement, that they think that if you just have a new law and new legal powers and more legal powers and more legal powers and more enforcement powers, somehow that's going to address the problem. And I just think that that is so wrong, and it's really unfortunate for the very workers that David represents, because I think their leaders are not helping them. Well, because their leaders are taking the wrong approach and thinking that if they just had new legislation, if we just had one more tool in our toolkit to go after folks, that will provide us with the silver bullet. And that is just wrong, and it's a mistake, and it's harmful for those very workers who I want them to have jobs. I want them to do well. I want everyone to have, you know, good, powerful jobs and be creative. I think that's fantastic. It's just, this isn't the right way.
Well, I'll tell you what, I know we could go on, but we wanted to give our listeners a flavor for the debate, and I appreciate the fact that both of you joined us today in Radio Times. David Cohen, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
It's a pleasure to meet you, if only by telephone and radio.
Well, that's what we do here every day at WHYY. David Cohen, AFL-CIO, Executive Director of the Department of Professional Employees. Corinne McSherry, thank you very much as well.
My pleasure. I was born in Philly. My dad lives there. It's great to be on WHYY.
You go. And she's a lawyer, intellectual property director for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And after this short break, we'll get back to our conversation with Larry Downs waiting in the wings, and we will carry on our conversation about SOPA and PIPA. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Bryn Mawr College Performing Arts Series welcomes the famed John Jaspers Company for a one-week residency culminating in the world premiere of Fort Blossom Revisited, 2000-2012. A reworking of Jaspers' legendary Fort Blossom. It's a personal look at the body and how we experience it, both as owners and spectators. Open to the public in the Hepburn Teaching Theater in Goodhart Hall, Friday, February 24th through Sunday the 26th, 610-526-5210 or brynmawr.edu/arts.
On the next Fresh Air, why the primary process is so confusing with different voting systems in different states. A look at the American primary process on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Mitt Romney should be feeling right at home in Michigan, where he was raised and where the next primary will be held. Instead, he finds himself in a real contest with Rick Santorum. Also, you can call him Dr. George Clinton. The funk master drops in on Berklee School of Music classes and gets a high honor. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Congress last month delayed voting on two anti-piracy bills known as SOPA and PIPA. And as we have been learning during this hour, critics argue that the passage would have been a threat to freedom of expression on the Internet. Supporters of the bill talked about rogue sites and the threat that rogue sites pose to companies and organizations and workers in this country. And again, we're taking advantage of this lull in the debate to understand what the debate was about and to see if there's some kind of compromise. And Larry Downs, who started us off, is now back. He's a consultant, author, talks about the intersection of technology, politics, and business. And he's currently a senior fellow with Tech Freedom, and that's a technology think tank. And Larry, I know you were listening as David Cohen and Corinne McSherry were debating SOPA and PIPA. Anything you want to add?
Well, I think your listeners got a pretty good sense of what most of us were hearing for the last several months in Washington, which was, the proponents and the opponents of these bills really just kind of talking over each other. There's very little actual conversation taking place about these bills or, you know, the sort of problem more generally, and obviously that's not a good way of going forward.
Yes, let me ask you about this Open Act, the Online Protection and Enforcement of Digital Trade Act. It's sponsored by Senator Ron Wyden, Representative Daryl Issa, as a way of getting to some kind of compromise. Do you see a compromise between these competing interests?
I do. I don't think the Open Act was perfect on the first go-around, but I think it was an awfully good start, and I really, praise Senator Wyden, Congressman Issa, and the other members of Congress who worked with them on this. The Open Act was a much more reasonable response to the actual problem of foreign rogue websites in that it was specifically aimed at only them, and it used, I thought, very smartly the existing mechanism of the International Trade Commission, which is an independent regulatory agency that already deals with issues having to do, for example, with patent infringement that happens outside the U.S. It's been around for 100 years or so. And the Open Act would have given them new authority to deal with copyright infringement activities happening outside the U.S., and they've already got the mechanisms, a very efficient judicial process for dealing with these kinds of claims. I think the Open Act would have had the best chance of having a positive impact on reducing the amount of foreign rogue activity that went on, and I hope it does actually move forward.
Yeah, I noticed you used the past tense. I mean, it's still under discussion, is it not?
Yes, in fact, it was only just introduced in both the Senate and the House, and I shouldn't have used the past tense. I don't think there's going to be much. There aren't going to be any hearings on it in the near future, again, just because of election season. But when we do return to this conversation, and I assure you, we will return to this conversation after the presidential election. My hope is that the Open Act is what we're talking about and not some, sort of mutated form of SOPA or PIPA.
Well, let me get some callers in on the conversation. If you have any questions or comments about SOPA and PIPA, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Larry, let's see what Paula from Williamstown has to say. Paula, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
I'm sorry. Hi. I had a comment to make and then a question to ask. My comment is that I think that it's extremely disingenuous for some of your guests to suggest that Google is not responsible for a large number of the protest emails that were sent to members of Congress on January 18th, when, you know, that's all that most people knew was that Google put up this page that said, oh, the government is trying to censor the Internet. And that's an overly simplistic explanation of this problem.
Fair enough.
And I just wanted to make that point first.
Sure, go ahead.
But the other thing I wanted to say is that I work in publishing, and specifically in STM, which is Science, Technology, and Medicine Publishing. And we have an enormous problem in our industry with piracy offshore and onshore, where, you know, 3 days after your best-selling textbook publishes, it's posted in its entirety online somewhere. And quite often these sites, not only they do post the content, but when you download it, you're also downloading some a virus. And so you're not only, you know, violating copyright law, but you're going to get this gruesome virus in exchange for that. But the people who are taking this content, downloading this content, that they know they have not paid for and that they know was created at someone else's expense, that is an active, malicious act. And I think that some sort of legislation, perhaps not as draconian as these two most recent pieces, but some sort of legislation has to address that issue.
Well, Paula, I'm glad you called, and it underscores a very important point. Let me give Larry Downs a chance to weigh in. Larry, your thoughts?
Yes, well, of course, I'm an author, too, so I certainly appreciate the benefits of copyright law. It's complicated, but here the problem, as I see it, is really bigger than this, and that is that, you know, as I said at the beginning of the show, in the last 20 years, we've enacted 15 or more pieces of legislation at the federal level to extend the penalties and enhance the benefits of copyright. The problem is that what this has really done is kind of, it's the equivalent of lowering the speed limit on the freeway from 55 miles an hour to 5 miles an hour. Almost anything that's done now with licensed content is going to be a violation, technically or otherwise, of copyright law. And what this has done is kind of created an atmosphere among consumers, even, you know, consumers who are fully law-abiding in every other aspect of their life, that they don't take copyright seriously. And it's very hard to educate them on the true harms of taking a content, unlicensed content, and not paying for it when they know that everything is a violation. And instead of actually making copyright more strict and more restrictive, what we ought to have done was to make it you know, less so and make, for example, fair use better, more open, and to, you know, kind of stop cutting off the flow of material into the public domain as we keep doing. And that's really the only way to get to sort of start the process of educating the public about why copyright is important and why copyright laws ought to be obeyed. They've got to be real laws. They've got to be laws that people will take seriously. And I'm afraid of all the damage that we've done to the copyright system over the last 20 years. It's very difficult to convince anyone to obey the law.
Paula, thanks for calling into Radio Times. This is not a legal question, Larry, but I just think people, they use the Internet. They don't think about, they generally don't think about where that information came from. Is it legal? Is it not legal? Did the person who created it, were they ever paid? I mean, people just use the, myself included, we use the Internet because we think it's there for us to use.
Yeah. Well, of course, you know, the thing about copyright in particular is information is not property the way, you know, a house or a car or a barrel of oil is property. And in fact, the very term intellectual property is really something of an oxymoron. When I look at your information, it's not as if I've literally gone in your house and stolen it. You still have the information. It's still there. In fact, the more people use it in some ways, the more valuable it becomes. And so when we kind of use, both from a legal standpoint and from a moral standpoint, this metaphor of property when we talk about information, it's also very confusing. And I think we would do better to drop that metaphor and talk about information use in a much more of a sense of licensing and how people are compensated, and, you know, where benefits do come from the use of information, rather than talking about it as a thing that can be stolen or hidden or lost.
Let me see what Tom from Ocean City has to say. Tom, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to get your thoughts on the fact that CBS Viacom, if you look back in the day, actually owned companies like CNET and Download. .com and the CDNet, which in turn promoted stuff like Morpheus and LimeWire and Kazaa, which pretty much gave people and kids the ability and the know-how to actually perform online piracy. And now that it's grown out of control, they're the same people that are saying this is bad when they're the ones that started in the first place. Am I wrong by saying that?
Well, that's fascinating. And I should add, Larry, that you write regularly for Forbes and CNET. Is he right? Is Tom right?
I do, and of course, I don't work for either of those companies, but I don't think it's entirely accurate. I mean, obviously, Viacom in particular has been one of the most active in particularly using the courts to try and enforce their rights and making use of existing mechanisms that, like the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, that, that let them send these notices to sites that have content up, like YouTube, and require them to take down unlicensed content. It may be that some of the sites that that Tom mentioned were putting up access to software that could have been used to download things illegally, but those software products also had legal uses as well, and obviously, you know, Viacom in particular is a big company, and what individual subsidiaries are doing doesn't necessarily suggest that they've kind of got a schizophrenia about the issue. I don't think there's any doubt Viacom's position on copyright is very clear.
Well, it sounded like Tom was saying that they created, you know, their own monster out of
all of this. That's probably a bit of an exaggeration.
All right, Tom, thanks for calling in. Let's see what Matt from Alden has to say. And Matt, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
I just think that the Internet gives consumers more power. You know, I think it completely changes the game of communism or of capitalism, how capitalism works. And, you know, I think that, you know, consumers are used to being charged for things by companies, you know, as much as possible for anything possible at any time possible. And I think most people accept that yeah, this is our system, this is capitalism, this is how our economy works. And it tends to work pretty well, but I think then when, you know, we now have the Internet, which completely changes things and puts some power back in the hands of consumers, mm-hmm. It brings it back to where if you have a good product and you offer it, you know, people will pay for it, and they'll pay what they feel it's worth. And then certain companies turn around and cry, you know, foul play. I don't think that really flies with a lot of people.
Well, Matt, let me see what our guest Larry Down says to your analysis there. Larry?
Yeah, I actually agree. I think that you know, what the Internet and online commerce is doing is really changing the rules of a lot of industries and making them more transparent, making kind of the pricing system more flexible if it's taken advantage of, and really it's the best thing that's happened to capitalism in a very long time. But obviously, if you've had generations of managers who have worked in a very different version of capitalism, where the companies had a lot more control over price and distribution and channel management, and that's certainly, I think, true of the entertainment industry for a very long time, it's very difficult to adapt and make that transition. I'm sympathetic to that as a consultant who works with large companies trying to manage the transition from physical to digital channels. But I think a lot of these industries have done themselves unintentionally a disservice by trying to use the courts and Congress to kind of preserve an old way of doing business that's, frankly, not the most profitable for them in the long run.
And are you sympathetic when Corinne talked about how the music industry, you know, figured out how to get around people that wanted to essentially take music and to give people what they wanted and allowing people to download songs?
Yes, I'm very sympathetic to that. I think, you know, the music industry and the movie industry now, they didn't really take digital distribution very seriously, and when they did take it seriously, they saw it as a threat. It really wasn't until things like iTunes and Spotify and Pandora came along, and of course these were things that were led by entrepreneurs and startups rather than the industry itself, but they've pretty much been dragged kicking and screaming into the 21st century. Now that they're there, I suspect, as we found with every previous technology that upsets the entertainment industry over the last 200 years, once we actually do adapt to it, we find that it makes things much better for everybody and, frankly, more profitable.
As Matt was describing how people use the Internet, we did a show yesterday about the social games that people play online and the fact that people will, you know, click a cow and just, you know, endlessly for their own entertainment, and someone can potentially make money off of that.
Yeah, it's a great world.
It is a great world.
I wish I had invented that cow.
Exactly. Let me ask you about, and this sort of happened while all the SOPA and PIPA debate was going on, but the Justice Department, the FBI, seized the website Mega Upload, charging a number of people with, you know, running I'm going to use the word piracy here, but running basically an illegal enterprise online. What's the significance of that, do you think?
Well, this is part of a long series. You know, one of the last pieces of legislation was a 2008 law called the Pro-IP Act, which gave the Department of Justice, or in this case the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Bureau, new powers to seize domain names under certain circumstances. Mega Upload didn't sort of disprove anything about SOAP and PIPA because, as I said before, it was a .com, so it was registered in the United States.
Right.
So the Justice Department already had jurisdiction over them. But what was interesting to me about it was that they coordinated with law enforcement agencies in New Zealand and elsewhere to make the arrests. And I think this really is the answer. If there is truly foreign criminal enterprises doing serious damage to, you know, U.S. interests, the answer is not to tinker with the engineering of the Internet here at home. It's to work with our trade partners. It's to work with our treaty partners in many cases, get them to enforce their treaty obligations, get them to enforce their own local copyright laws. Copyright is essentially uniform in the developed world today anyway. Use things like the World Trade Organization and so on. If the real problem is a foreign trade problem, we have mechanisms for dealing with that, and beefing those up is a much, much more sensible approach than trying to rewrite the code of the Internet for people who don't even use it.
Well, Larry Downs, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure, Marty.
And he's a consultant, author, writes about the intersection of technology, politics, and business, author of several books, including Unleashing the Killer App, Digital Strategies for Marketing for Market Dominance. He's written for USA Today, Wired, and the Harvard Business Review, writes regularly for Forbes and CNET. And if that weren't enough, he's a senior fellow with Tech Freedom, that's a technology think tank. Well, that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Al Banks, the engineer. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder, and Jonathan Best, who produced this show. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.